Episode 270 of the Pilot to Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics, then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot. The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app. This episode is brought to you by Bose Aviation. Elevate your flying experience with a new Bose A30 Aviation headset. With unmatched comfort and three modes of active noise cancellation, the A30 Aviation headset strips away distractions so you can focus on the freedom of flight. Quiet the noise, amplify the experience at bose.com/A30. Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. My name is Justin Seams and I am your host. Today's episode is a state of the industry episode with Dr. Jim Higgins, where we get a deep dive into the industry. We talk about strike authorization votes. We talk about contracts. We talk about automation, pretty much anything and everything aviation. So if you're into these episodes, please share these with all your friends because they are just some great, great information. And Jim is one of the best in the industry at sharing this stuff. So it's awesome to have him on and hear his opinion on what's going on in the industry. So Aviation, without any further ado, here's episode 270 with Dr. Jim Higgins. Jim, what's going on, man? Welcome to the Pilot the Pilot podcast.
Thanks, Justin. Always good to be back and always good to talk with you.
Right. Welcome back. We're doing these more frequent, so people should be, they've always been asking, get Jim back on. I was like, well, he's here. All right. We're getting him for you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. The last episode was great. Hearing more about your story. And just hearing about how you got to where you are and how you're so smart and the knowledge that you have, or at least maybe you're faking it till you make it, making up everything and sounding smart. But nonetheless, you are imparting wisdom on all of us and helping us just and helping everyone get through this crazy career that we have.
I appreciate you saying that. Yes, it's a lot of difficult lessons along the way. I know a lot of people have stories similar, but I'm glad that we can share some of this and some of the insight. And hopefully make it a better industry for everybody.
Absolutely. So let's dig in. We have a couple topics that we're going to talk about. The first one, I feel like most people that listen to this are probably honestly your students or people in that kind of mindset where they are getting ready to enter the airline world, enter their job, you know, make the first big bucks. So be it, however you want to call it. Even though now flight instructors get paid pretty well, but they're at 1,000 hours, they're at 1,500 hours, they're making their way to a regional. And it was booming. I mean, it still is booming, right? But there are some drawbacks or there are some setbacks that are kind of easing into the picture. And I don't necessarily think it's recession-based, and you might have more insight on this, but I think it could be more of like a bottlenecking in the actual training department that's keeping and preventing them from either upgrading or getting people in the simulators and has to slow down their hiring.
There is no doubt that we have seen, I guess you could characterize it as a slowdown with FOs at regional airlines. There's lots of reasons for that. I agree with you. It's not recession-based at all. One has to back up to the capacity agreements that regional airlines sign with their mainline partners, whether they're wholly owned or restricted or they're part of several different major airline contracts. These contracts basically stipulate that the mainline carrier is going to be the one that says, you will fly this route, you will fly that route, you'll fly this route. Well, the mainlines have learned, this is just my editorial now, but I think the mainlines have learned that given the, whatever word you want to look at, operational inefficiencies at times, in part because of the inability to hire enough pilots, the mainlines have been hiring, as you know, full on. And so they're now pretty well staffed and they'll take as many as will show up. But I think you're starting to see some of that transfer. If you look at to the main lines from the regional. So if you look at some of the routes, this is very anecdotal, just in our market here, but we're starting to see into Grand Forks and Fargo, we're starting to see mainline flights a lot more, whether it's an Airbus or even the smaller, the 100-passenger range aircraft that the mainlines are flying, you'll start to see them coming into some of these markets areas before you would have just seen it serve with a 50 or 70-seat type of regional. So I think there's some of that upgauging to the mainline occurring. which also is reflected in the ticket prices, which have definitely increased a little bit when adjusted for inflation. And then also the training bottlenecks at the regionals are difficult. So there's several parts of the training that cause big issues for the training departments. You know, the first one are just the structural ones. You know, is there enough sim time that's rented out, enough sim time available, things of that nature. Then, of course, there's the simulator instructors and the simulator check pilots. Those are a little easier to create. Where the real bottlenecks come is with the line check airmen and also with the line captains. The line captains have to go through a Fed ride, is what it's collectively called, where an FAA examiner, inspector, will sit and actually watch you fly a route at the end of your IOE or at some point during your IOE. Some companies have been able to get relief and they're allowed to do that themselves, but that's not all across the industry. So that's one bottleneck. But then the line check airmen are another bottleneck. It takes a lot to create a line check airman. They have to go through a lot of training. They do have to be observed by the FAA giving a line check. And these are the folks that will do the IOE when either a new hire or a new captain transitions out of the sim. And when those folks get hired at a mainline, it just cavitates the training capabilities because it's a minimum of 2 months really to get a new line check airman letter to somebody. So it's a really big deal. That's why you're seeing in some cases really strong incentivization for line check airmen to stay where they're at. Some of the regionals are making it very painful financially to leave and then go work for a mainline.
Yeah, but they're still leaving, right? Like there's only so much you can do, you know?
Yeah, and it's short term, right? I mean, you can pay someone a lot of money in the short term, but the math, this is an age old argument. The math on the retirement alone, the difference between a regional and a mainline, you know, it's several million dollars just on the retirement alone. I've often heard this, and this is no knock on my regional friends. I worked as a regional pilot for a very long time, but I have heard, and I have no doubt to not believe this, that the worst mainline carrier is way, way better in terms of quality of life, pay and work rules, everything else, than the best regional that's out there. And maybe that line's getting blurred a little bit, but I have definitely heard that. And that seems to be kind of what everyone reports around the industry.
You kind of mentioned in the beginning of your answer, talking about how a regional really has no say in what it's going to fly. Like they're kind of, I mean, they can bid essentially for the routes that they want to fly and partner with airlines. But at the end of the day, they are pretty much assigned these routes from United, from Delta, from American. Do you ever see a world where, I mean, I'm just going to say SkyWest because they're the first that comes to my mind and I think they're the biggest regional. I want to say they're the biggest regional, but they're massive, right? Is there ever a world where they're like, you know what? We're a pretty darn good airline. Let's try to go for it. Let's get a 737. Let's get some bigger airplanes and see what we can do.
SkyWest is massive. They're generally regarded as very well run. I know that's a lot of people on the pilot side would like to see a union in place there to represent some of the workers, but no doubt they're a behemoth, right? They're huge. And if there was going to be a regional that tried to make a jump to a standalone independent, they would be a likely choice. Republic's another one that comes to mind, but we've seen that script play out before. If you recall the old Atlantic Coast Airlines, ACA, Blue Ridge was their call sign. Very, very proud airline, started out as a United carrier out of Dulles and Chicago and a lot of other places, growing, was kind of the place to go work amongst the regional pilots. If you could get there, good, RJ destination, and, you know, it was an ALPA carrier. You know, I had checked all the boxes. And for some reason, I don't know all the details behind it. I'm sure people listening, some of them know more of the details, but they fell out of favor with their mainline. And they realized that they had some assets, in particular in Dulles, they had gates that they owned outright. And so they did exactly what you just brought up, Justin. They're like, you know, let's get a large aircraft. I can't recall, it's been a few years, whether it was a 737 or an Airbus, but they tried to go that route. They tried to go it alone and do some independent flying and, just got slaughtered through no fault of the people running it. It's very difficult. You know, we can talk about this more macro-y, but It's very difficult to ever make an anti-competition claim in this industry. You know, whether it's Southwest, for instance, a lot of people think that they can be anti-competitive when they're going head to head with somebody. So they do all kinds of things, right? They'll bracket a launch time. So let's say you have a flight that goes from Dulles to Chicago, and it leaves at 6 a.m. in the morning. When you do that, you can elicit a response from a highly competitive carrier like Southwest, for instance. They would launch a flight at 5:55 and another one at 6:05, and they would bracket your launch, and they can do it. They can do it at a loss, right, until you go away. That's never been proven. There's been several lawsuits, but it's never been proven that a carrier has done that. But I'm telling you, that's the way the competition works. So it's so hard to be an independent nowadays to launch. You know, we do see places like Breeze, Sun Country, Allegiant. They kind of carve out their own niches, but it'd be really tough for a regional. Most recently, we saw the old ASA ExpressJet. Now, I'm sorry, I'm dating myself, but we saw them try to make a try of it too, right? And it was really, it's difficult. It's just the barriers to enter and execute in this industry are significant, to say the least.
Well, especially when you have kind of the big four, essentially. They don't want to let anyone else in on their big pie that they have, you know? It's like they have the ability and they will play it as long as possible to make it as tough as possible for you to make it. Because at the end of the day, you just truly can't pay or charge the same rates that they're going to charge. I mean, think about Southwest going to Hawaii and how they really ran a strong campaign. I don't know if what their end goal was to get rid of Hawaii Airlines or kind of just like, but they really kind of undercut them on everything that they could. And now I haven't caught back up and figured out how they're doing now, but they're still operating out there. So obviously things are going pretty well. So it's definitely an interesting game, isn't it?
When a company like Southwest, I know they've had operational problems recently, which we've talked about, but when a company like Southwest, especially the old Southwest, when they come to compete, they put on their football helmets and they come to compete. It's really difficult. If you have a network that's 10% the size of a place like a Southwest or a United or whomever, insert whoever the big carriers in there, it's very easy for them to compete with you in your market because they can lose money there forever. There's no end to it because they can subsidize it with the places that you're not at. And so they do a great job with that. The way the low-cost carriers work is they do a lot of hub bypass and point-to-point, and they just go so cheap, and then they do the ancillary income that the calculations made by places like Southwest and United and other places, they're like, okay, well, we're not going to get those customers anyway because of their price inelasticity. So they let those go, but that's about the only way you can carve a niche anymore and try to compete, head to head with some of these big carriers. So difficult to start an airline now.
Well, it leads to like so many different kind of interesting questions. Like, all right, so low cost carriers, Spirit, JetBlue, that ever gets any traction, but if that ever gets passed by the DOJ, they're going to have to forfeit a bunch of gates. Does that leave the opportunity for, I don't want to say like a Breeze because I honestly don't really know what's going on with them either, but like a Breeze or even say like SkyWest, like, oh, cool, all these gates just popped up. Why don't we go grab some and then see what happens, you know?
Absolutely. Everyone's very opportunistic. So when there is a airline death or some type of a regulatory issuance, whether it's routes or gates or landing slots, whatever the case may be, absolutely, people will go for those and try to make it work. I mean, one of the most glaring examples was the 80s, 90s, a little bit into the 2000s, the East Coast shuttles. There was just every major airline ran an East Coast shuttle that basically went Boston, New York, DC, and back and forth, right? And they would time it for the morning, so you could literally live in New York and work in Boston or vice versa. And those were hyper competitive. I mean, sometimes you'd get like $10, $15 fares. And, those ran for years. And and every now and then someone would think, well, I could do that. I could put a Saab on there or, an ATR or something. But it's just so hard to enter those particular markets. Just too thin of a margin.
It really is. And it's really interesting. Like the just the time that we're in, whether pilots are getting paid a ton of money, we have an airline trying to merge, and what is JetBlue going to want to do? Is JetBlue going to truly attack the kind of the big four and kind of ruffle some feathers? They're clearly going after the international market. The Spirit one really connects the dots of the country for JetBlue, where before it was mainly East Coast and West Coast, and now they're going to be all over the Midwest, especially Detroit, with probably becoming a major hub, I'd imagine, with how big Spirit was there. So it's, the landscape's going to change a little bit. I clearly don't think anything's really going to change at the top. Like, it's always going to be Delta, American, United, and Southwest, most likely. But I don't know. It's just, there's some, the industry can be ruffled up a little bit.
It can. The big knocks against low cost carriers, and you could certainly put even a Southwest and a JetBlue in there, is just long term, where are they going to grow, right? So you have single fleet types or maybe just a couple fleet types throughout the fleet. And, you know, they get the domestic market saturated. They find their little niches, which are lucrative in some cases, especially when you look at, like Orlando or Las Vegas or other vacation destinations. And they really carve it out and they get it dialed in. But, you know, a company has to grow. It can't stagnate. And so, you know, a moment ago, you brought up Southwest going to Europe, the ETOPs for the 737s and narrow bodies. The new Neos coming from Airbus on the A320s. These things are very important to these companies. They're actually for their growth because, you know, they've never really pushed international beyond, you know, like Canada and the Caribbean and Mexico. And now you're going to start seeing it. The question is going to be, are any of these carriers eventually going to launch into Asia? I mean, no offense, you know, my wife flies a 737, so this is no knock. You know, I flew a Saab, so what am I talking about? But I would just have great difficulty sitting on a 737 for 12 hours if that ever becomes possible.
Yeah, no worries.
Go across the Pacific. I just don't know where some of these places are going to grow, or are they going to change their business plan and add wide bodies to access some of these markets? I don't know. Probably code sharing. You might see, you know, things like that occur. But it's going to be, there's still a lot of room to grow in the Midwest and other parts of the U.S. But ultimately, there is going to be a wall. There's only so many people and so much capacity you could put in any particular O&D. And so it's going to be, something's going to have to happen. People are going to have to change, whether they merge, whether they add different types of aircraft to go international. I mean, we see JetBlue's going to Europe. You're going to start seeing narrow bodies going to Europe. But, you know, it still leaves out Asia, which is still the fastest growing market for air passengers and cargo, for that matter.
Yeah, and Asia is a little interesting. United is very much seeing how difficult that can be in tough times, because they are, I think they're still the biggest influence in the Asian market, if I'm not mistaken. And when COVID hit, and granted, that was kind of like the perfect storm or the worst storm for them, because that was a big moneymaker for them, and losing that was pretty rough. So I'd imagine with the geopolitical issues that are going on right now, United has to be just a little bit nervous of what's going on over there, and knowing how much of their business relies kind of on the Asian market.
Yeah, there's risk everywhere, and it depends on one's perspective. Look at it from a pilot perspective. You know, a lot of pilots aspire to fly a wide body international. And if that's something you aspire to do, a place like United or FedEx even, those would be places that, because they have a very high percentage of wide bodies that fly international. But on the other side, like you're saying there, there's extra risk, right? The risk in this case was COVID, but there's other types of risk as well, geopolitical risk, things like that. So you're absolutely right. You know, every carrier is, even amongst the main lines, the legacies, they've all carved out kind of what they do best. You know, United is known for its international flying, but and the others are no slouches in there as well. But these are all, when one makes a decision, where am I going to go work? What airline do I want to work for the rest of my life? These are all probably variables that have to go into the equation when you make your decision.
Yeah. And you brought up FedEx. I believe they have still halted all pilot hiring. I wouldn't say they look bad there, but it definitely looks a little bit different on the freight side. And I'm talking about like big metal freight. I'm not sure about what's going on at Ameriflight or any of those programs whatsoever. But right. UPS, FedEx, I haven't heard much from, my gosh, it's blanking. What's the other one?
DHL, Amazon, Airborne.
Yeah, those. But specifically the ones that fly, they got the last 747.
Oh, Oh, yeah. Who was that?
Atlas.
Why don't I know that?
Atlas.
Yeah, you're right.
There we go.
It wasn't Atlas, was it?
It was Atlas.
Atlas. Okay. Yeah. I should have known that.
Things don't look as bright on the front. Like I said, I don't know if bright is the right word to use right now, but things are a little bit different over there than they seem to be on the airline side. Would you agree?
Well, are they different in terms of pilot hiring today? Absolutely, right? For instance, you know, FedEx hasn't hired yet this year, and they've announced that they probably won't hire for this year. So that's a dramatic announcement to make. When you look at the amount, and you know, I think UPS is hiring small. UPS's hiring has always been, I don't know what word I want to use, eclectic. I mean, you'll see them all of a sudden rush and hire 40 and then not hire anyone for like 6 months and then hire five. That's an odd one there. All of the above, but when you look at like the Atlas and the carriers that do a lot of Amazon Prime flying, you know, they're doing pretty well in terms of pilot hiring. And so when you look at freight in general, internationally, you know, globally, it is down from last year. I believe in January it was down about 15% in terms of freight tonnage moved than the previous January. In February, which is where the latest info we have, it was down 7% from the previous. So one of the talking points right now that's being bantered about freight is it is still down, but it's slowing. It's slightly recovering and maybe decelerating. It's low. So maybe it's hit the bottom. When you look historically, everyone knows this, but during the pandemic, freight spiked, right? Because nobody wanted to go to stores anymore and everyone was ordering things. And so there was kind of an artificial inflation in there. But, you know, just before the pandemic, there was an interesting thing going on in the freight industry. FedEx and Amazon had a well-publicized divorce. I don't know if you remember that, but it was pretty dramatic. And FedEx basically stopped doing anything Amazon, and Amazon had to go out and start their own airline. And they quote unquote have an airline, but it's flown by several different carriers, right? Atlas being, you know, one of the biggest, but there are others as well. Yeah, Sun Country, others. And so the question is how are they doing? Well, they've been doing okay. They've been maintaining. They're still hiring. They are adding routes. And so the question is, even though FedEx and UPS has contracted a little bit, it doesn't seem to be affecting the Amazon Prime carriers right now yet today. And so I don't know if we can quite yet say that we've reached some kind of a big problem amongst pilot hiring in the freight side. Certainly FedEx and UPS, who, by the way, in my opinion, have by far the best contracts out there. I know FedEx is going for a new one, and I wish the pilots there well, but these are really strong contracts as they are. So these are definitely destination carriers, but it's going to be very, very interesting to see in the next 6 months what happens with freight. But historically speaking, we're still fine. We're at pre-pandemic levels, or just slightly below pre-pandemic levels. So it's not like there's been it's not like everything went away. It's not like there's no wind behind the sail. It's just not a violent wind like we saw during the pandemic.
Well, and everyone, I want to say everyone, but there's no way they could have kept that up, I feel like. You know, that was kind of like, it was just everything was working. Like everything was max. And eventually it had to be a little bit of pullback, you know,
If you had a chance to talk to any FedEx pilot or management person during the pandemic, they will tell you before the pandemic, they were very, very busy, what they call their peak season, right? Which is basically Thanksgiving to just after Christmas, right? That's their peak season. And during that time, all bets are off. Everyone's all hands on deck. Everyone's working their butt off. And it's a really, really crazy time. And then try to recuperate a little bit in January, February, because of, you know, it was just, you know, pedal to the floor during that entire time. During the pandemic, that peak season existed 24/7, 365. There were no breaks. The fact is I think it was the MD-11s were going to be retired. They weren't at the time, at least. Now we're starting to see it a little bit. But they were going full tilt. And, you know, the organization was very, very much stretched and stressed. So I agree with you. I don't know if they could have continued that pace indefinitely. I think it was getting to be kind of tiring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about this a couple episodes ago where we talked about how what's going on, all these mishaps, what's going on, all these near misses. And it's, in my mind, I mentioned that I think it's I think the industry is stretched. FAA, I think ATC, I think airlines, pilots, ground workers, literally anyone in aviation right now is very, very much tired, essentially. and it's crazy. And it might be a good thing to see somewhat of a slowdown just so everyone kind of get a catch their breath. Maybe gives the FAA a chance to hire some more controllers. Maybe gets everyone a chance to hire some controllers. So it's maybe a recession won't be the worst thing in the world. And I truly don't know what an actual recession would look like. I don't know if it stops hiring just because we are getting ready to hit the peak of retirements, right? Like they need all the pilots that they can get right now just to maintain for the next year or two. So they can't even really, I mean, they can't hire enough, but it's pretty difficult to hire everyone that they need to, especially making sure they're quality pilots, right? There's a difference between hiring a quality pilot just to hire. There's a difference between hiring a quality pilot or hiring a pilot just to hire a pilot, you know? Let's take a break from today's episode and hear from our sponsor, RAA. Hey, Justin here. And look, investment planning is complicated stuff. That's why my partners at RAA created a free virtual workshop where their airline specialized advisors will answer the top four investment questions people in airline community are asking today. Like how to make the most out of cash on hand strategies for asset allocation, Roth conversions, and more. There are two dates to attend, May 23rd and May 25th. Join from home, between flights, or wherever it's convenient for free. It's RAA's virtual investment planning workshop, May 23rd and May 25th. Register today at raa.com/events. And now back to today's episode. So it's interesting times for that too.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Just as a quick aside to that, and I'm sure you've heard these stories too, there are pilots that do get hired at both the regionals and the main lines that it's still a very, very, very small percent. But there are some that are not getting through training, even today with all the pilot hiring. I know there was a little bit of a talking point or a notion out there that perhaps the airlines have eased up on their standards. You know, again, if someone has a good attitude, I'm sure they're going to get extra sim sessions or whatever. But no, there's the standards are still being upheld. So they're hopefully, and to your point, hopefully we're still seeing people get to the flight deck, you know, completely qualified. My feeling is we are, but I do agree with what you said earlier. We are stressed and stretched quite a bit. Regarding the recession, you know, the last recession we saw was the Great Recession, 2008, 2009. During that housing crisis, it's very possible we're either in one or we'll go in another recession. And what's going to happen? Well, the big difference now between now and then is, and I know I've said this so many times, you're going to get tired of me talking about this, but the airlines have absolutely learned how to make money during downturns. And it's through the ancillary income, and, you know, that what we know as baggage fees and convenience fees and booking fees. It's absolutely a game changer. And they've only consumed about 50% of that potential as it is. They could easily turn that up if they need to. If you talk to any CEO or any CFO in the industry, they will tell you they do not fear a recession like they did, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It's not that they're recession proof. No one's saying that. But they've absolutely learned how to handle the ups and downs by still bringing in enough revenue. That being said, we're going to probably see a test of that. With the pilot hiring during a recession, to your point, Justin, that is going to be something to watch. My feeling is the airlines learned a lesson after the pandemic that they let too many people go in early retirements and, you know, early or, you know, voluntary furloughs, layoffs, things like that. And so they've learned now that even if there's a little bit of a surplus, they've learned they still have to bring these pilots on board because all airlines have growth plans. And as you just mentioned, the crux of the retirements haven't hit either. So if the airlines want to continue to operate and even, dare I say, consider growth, they do need to hoard their pilots right now as much as possible.
Yeah, we're talking about hoarding. What have you heard about age 67? Does that have any legs? Do you think there's a possibility that it could be passed? Or is this kind of just airlines really trying to push off the inevitable of not having enough pilots?
I do think that age 67 could eventually come to pass. But there's a couple things to say about that. You know, if I had to put a probability on it, I don't know if it's going to be. I know there's legislation right now that has been swirling. ALPA and other labor groups are vehemently opposing it. We can talk about some of the philosophies there as well. If you recall, one of the biggest reasons why we went from 60 to 65, and a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I'm just telling you, I lived it and I talked to the negotiators at the different unions. You know, back in the day when people would negotiate, we had pensions at the mainline carriers. So when you hit age 60, you didn't have to worry about whether Social Security was going to kick in or not, right? Well, the pensions went away after the, you know, the economic downturn after 9/11. There were too many airlines went into bankruptcy. They used bankruptcy either to restructure their defined benefit plans, or what we call pensions, or in some cases, wholesale got rid of them, right? Completely unfair to the pilots. I know we've talked about this before, but all of a sudden now you had pilots that were forced retired at age 60, and they weren't eligible for Social Security until 65. So they literally went from where they thought they had a nice nest egg of a retirement where they could retire comfortably at 60 to all of a sudden going to, you know, zero income for 5 years. I mean, imagine the, and in some cases, some of these pilots were in their 50s when they discovered that. So just a horrible, horrible time. So in my opinion, one of the reasons why ALPA got rid of their position against age 65 was because they realized they had a lot of members that were going to go without any pay at all for 5 years. And so they stopped opposing the age 65. The second they stopped opposing it, it was fine. You saw them pass it really fast. I mean, so it went to age 65. Now onto the 67, we do have a similar issue, although I don't know if everything's the same. But as you know, the Social Security payment age is climbing. So my age group, it will be 67. I'm 51. When I turn 60, I won't get Social Security until I'm 67. And a lot of other people in your generation, Justin, you could probably even expect that to be a later age. So there will be pilots that are forced retired at 65 that are in some cases, you know, if they didn't have a good enough retirement or something happened, they're going to go without their safety net, which is Social Security, for a couple of years. So there is going to be some pressure. All of that being said, people have to realize that right now, as we speak, only about 3 out of 5 pilots retire at age 65 anyway. Most retire early for a number of reasons, medical being the biggest. I suspect that number would even go less at 65, perhaps 2 out of 5, because we just start having issues as we get older. It's just the way it is right now. And so I don't know if even if it's raised to age 67, I don't know if it's going to have as big of an impact as the age 65 did in terms of pilot supply.
So you think it's more of a retirement and that kind of avenue of going down this, and not necessarily like a Hail Mary for the airlines being like, oh, cool, let's get all these pilots, let's bring them back for another 2 years. They'll make top of the scale pay for another 2 years, so they're not going to leave. And it kind of just gives us more time to worry about the pilot shortage.
Yeah, well, for sure. Absolutely. Do I think the people that are working the pilot shortage and fleet planning and personnel staffing planning, do they think that this would help them in the short term? Absolutely. And it would help them in the short term. I suspect to be about 40% of the pilots would go beyond 65 for those extra 2 years. And I'm sure they're looking at no single solution right now is going to help. So this would just be one of many solutions, but absolutely they're looking at it from that perspective. I just think politically speaking, in order to get it across the finish line with Congress raising it, someone's going to have to kind of go through the same reasoning as we saw before.
Got it. Okay. That makes more sense then. And then there's also rumblings of, I don't know if it's regionals or if it's everyone, but trying to bring down the actual hour recommendations or the hour rules for how many hours you need to actually get a good job. Is that correct?
That is correct. But let me tell you about that. So that obviously came from the Colgan accident. And again, ALPA is vehemently opposed to this. So are many other groups. The groups that really want to see it lowered, of course, are the regional airlines, the RAA, as an advocacy group for them. So I'm very familiar with this issue. So I'm going to say some controversial things. Controversial thing number one, I did my master's thesis on this. Of course, it was back in 05, but I did my master's thesis on this. And I will tell you right now, the number of hours in a pilot's logbook is not predictive of skill or competency. It just isn't. I can tell you to a scientific fact, there's so many studies out there that show that it just isn't a good indicator. That being said, believe it or not, if that 1,000 hour restricted ATP rule or the 1,500 hour ATP rule was lessened, if that was ever brought down, you would immediately see an even bigger shortage at the airlines. As funny as that sounds. And let me tell you why. The biggest issue right now with flight training at the collegiate and also a civilian world for primary training from private all the way to CFI is you got to have CFIs who can train other CFIs. And as you know, there's rules with that. They have to have 200 hours of dual given and so much time. And it turns out about the time that a lot of these pilots get that certification to teach other flight instructors, they're just about coming up on their restricted ATP and their ATP minimums. So in some cases, we're only getting those particular instructors for, you know, maybe a few months of flight instruction. And so if all of a sudden this this restricted ATP rule was lessened, even though it doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't increase safety at all. Maybe that's too bold of a statement. It doesn't give us the safety effect that we had hoped. I can prove that scientifically, but I can tell you practically that would absolutely cause a collapse amongst new CFIs, which would cause a bigger bottleneck for primary pilots coming through. I know that sounds crazy, but that's actually the truth of the matter, on what it goes. So yes and yes, if that answers your question, I do see a lot of pressure against that. But I do think it could also cause major problems if we ever did lower that, but not for the reasons that a lot of people think.
Well, it almost sounds like the only option would be to just kind of move more toward the European model then, if that is the case.
Well, the MPL, or the multi-crew pilot's license, is a European model. You also see it in Australia and in Asia. And again, widely fought against in the US. For those that aren't familiar, a multi-crew pilot's license, or MPL, is kind of a concept where a new hire pilot shows up at their company from day one. They learn how to fly the Airbus. Yes, they go through some primary training. Yes, they go through some instrument training. Yes, they go through some other things. But one, they're never alone. There's never a solo, as a general rule of thumb. And they just learn how to manage the flight deck from the right seat. They learn how to talk on the radio. They learn how to manage the aircraft systems. And, you know, there's a high washout rate and the European folks, some of the Asian flight carriers and Australian flight carriers get kind of mad. They get kind of mad at me when I come out against the MPL because, they'll tout their safety record. But the truth is, and this is going to be super controversial, Justin, so I'm sorry. I don't want to bring it down with me.
It's all you,
but
man.
For instance,
your voice.
When you look at that 737 issue, right, with the controllability issue and the Lion's Air and a couple of the others, I will tell you that I understand that same type of issue happened with United States pilots, US-based Air 121 carriers, at least seven times previously from flight data, right? They had a similar situation. And all seven times, the crew figured out how to turn it off and land with those controllability problems. Now, that brings up bigger issues, like why wasn't that information communicated overseas? You know, why wasn't that addressed? That's a much bigger issue. But I am of the belief that as imperfect as the system is here in the United States, what I call the system of hard knocks, where you have to go out, especially on the civilian side, but the military it's also very difficult. You go out and you go through all this flight training. And we talked about it before. It's all this pressure and there's rejection and there's self-doubt and you make it through and you finally get your check ride. You earn your private pilot and you move on to the next thing. And you go through all these obstacles, nearly impossible in some cases. You make it through and you get yourself to the line. Man, I think our process does something to you. It teaches you to be a better decision maker. It teaches you to think through some of these things. And the MPL, we've also seen much bigger mental health issues with MPL pilots. Again, another controversial statement, but we've seen that. And so I'm not a big believer in the MPL at all for safety reasons. And then I also worry long term for captains, right? So even if you could teach a professional first officer, you know, how to be a first officer and what buttons to hit. And, you know, I know I'm probably really offending some people that are MPL pilots. And I'm sorry about that. I know they do a lot more than that. But my point is even if you can train somebody, what's it look like when you eventually need a captain, they have to transition over and they haven't gone through that hardcore process of forming themselves. Again, maybe there's a better way and maybe it's an amalgamation of both, but I am no fan of the MPL process from a safety point of view. It does, in fact, though, solve pilot shortages. There's no doubt. It's not any less expensive. In fact, it might be a little more expensive for air carriers, but the time, right? You don't have to spend as much time hatching a pilot like you do in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to, like I said, I don't know as much as you do. So if anyone directs that hate, I'll give them your email so you can argue about it. But there is something to kind of like our process of how you're kind of thrown in the fire and you got to figure it out, you know, good luck, make it work. You got 100 right. hours and you're building your instrument time and you're on a solo and things go wrong. You're in the plane. You got to learn from this adversity. And the crazy thing about it is all these situations everything that's bad that happens to you in the cockpit, this adversity, it hardens you and it makes you the pilot and the captain that you're going to be. Because a lot of times when you're a captain, you can draw back from stuff that's happened way long ago, whether how it's affecting the airplane, winds, terrain, turbulence, like all this stuff that you can draw back on and use to become a good captain on a 787 or 737. So it's not just about flying an Airbus from day one. It's really being the person that has to say yes, no, or do this, do that, you know, like that really, really, really can make you a really good pilot. And I mean, obviously you can go through it and be a good pilot without any adversity, but the adversity really kind of forces you to be good or else bad stuff happens.
Yeah, that's right. You can direct the hate towards me because I probably will get it. I have gotten it before. I hate maybe is a strong word, but strong disagreement, right? But even the Air France off of South America, you know, the captain was in the back. They was relieved by two MPL pilots up front. I mean, this is, again, it's really easy to second guess people. But you know, when you pull back on the yoke and the stall shift, you know, and the airspeed increases more and more, and you're basically looking up at straight up at the sky. And, you know, the stall warning goes away because, you know, on the Airbus, the stall warning is inhibited below 40 knots because, you know, when would you ever be below 40 knots in flight in an Airbus? But and you don't reason to yourself, wow, I have to keep pulling. You think to yourself, I have to keep pulling back because my airspeed is increasing and the stall warning went away. So I'm obviously but at some point, what happened to control performance? What happened to just pitch and power? And I don't know. Again, I'm sounding like an American exceptionalist, right? And saying that, you know, do it our way. But to your point, I think that most pilots in the U.S., most airline pilots in the U.S. at some point would say, I'm at 30 degrees nose up and my airspeed's increasing. One of my instruments is lying to me, right? And that's why we just don't see, those types of, so controversial, I'm sure, but we don't see those types of accidents here, in my opinion, as often. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about, which is just the school of hard knocks and, you know, learning how to kind of reason through things and, you know, some of the techniques that we've been trained with. I'm sorry if I'm being extra controversial today.
No, not at all. The one, I don't want to say good thing, but a huge roadblock for any kind of regional carrier or the RAA, not the retirement company that sponsors me, so I'm not talking bad about them, but RAA, the Regional Airline Association, just want to make sure it's clear. But the Colgan Group, I mean, that lobby group is nothing to mess with. You are going to have to fight them until the end to change those hour marks. So I really don't know if that would ever get changed. So it would take something very drastic and a lot of money.
Yeah. And I, you know, obviously our heart goes out to the families of the Colgan victims. They did coalesce unlike anything we've ever seen before. And they absolutely were able to bring change, you know, to the industry. The public law that went out in 2010 is absolutely something that changed dramatically. I mean, even recently, I don't know if you've heard about the pilots records database, the PRD rules. They're coming into effect now. And these things go all the way back in theory, all the way back to your pre-solo records. So now a pilot's going to build a record, and it's way more than PREA, the Pilots Record Improvement Act, and the FAA is going to start cracking down on operators that don't comply with PRD, and that was a direct result of the Colgan accident. Ironically, one of the things in that Colgan accident, I think that may have been missed, which is a whole other topic, we can talk about it someday, was the background of the captain, right? And so I think that backgrounds of a pilot, you know, the type of training, things like that are definitely important. But I think in many of these cases, this overreach, well, that's really, I'm sure the Colgan families wouldn't like to hear that word either. I do think a lot of these were kind of feel good ideas that I don't know if we got the complete safety effect that everyone desired. Certainly we've been safe. You know, we just haven't had a lot of, I think we had the Southwest, decompression accident, and that's about it. So one death in over 10 years, right? Over a decade. It's you know, very impressive to say the least. That being said, when you really look at it, like for instance, take a look at the pilot, the rules now to become a 121 carrier, you know, both those pilots at Colgan had well over, one of the FO had 2,200 and the captain had 4,500 hours. You know, so for instance, that 1500 hour rule wouldn't have affected that particular flight. And when you look at like the last, I think it was the last 100, 121 accidents in the US, there was only one instance where one pilot had below 1500 hours. But that being said, you know, the system is what it is. As I told you earlier, logistically and practically, we need that to keep the number of CFIs, you know, going. But from a safety point of view, I don't know that we're actually getting what, you know, what the data thinks we, or what people thought we were going
to
get.
Yeah, but to be fair, back when you're looking back past 2010, 2000s, 1990s, you had first officer had 5,000 hours, you know, you couldn't get hired anywhere less than that. So, right. I don't know if the sample size was really there for under, I mean, obviously you still had pilots that got hired that slipped through the cracks and could get hired at 300 hours, 500 hours, but it wasn't the norm whatsoever. You had to have a ton of hours. People think 1500 is bad now. You were a CFI with 5,000 hours, hoping you can get a single pilot freight job in some instances. Absolutely. Right? So it is a little bit different when you look at it that way. And then also at least something happened, right? Like when something crazy happens like that and not seeing anything change, then you know something, like you did something wrong. Like to get some kind of change, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, I'm not going into that. People constantly, I put up a joke post because the FAA chairman, he's stepping down or he's not going to do that anymore. It's like, hey, FAA, let me run it. Like, I'd love to. It'd be awesome. It'd be an honor. Sign me up. And I mean, I was half joking. Like, I honestly do think it'd be a cool job and I would love to do it. But nonetheless, I put up another post saying, what would you do when you're in the FAA? And a lot of them were lower the mins, lower the mins, lower the mins. Like, I don't know if that's a good idea. I don't think we should lower the mins. It goes back to what we're talking about. You learn so much in those 250 to 1500, 250 to 1000 hours based on the pathway that you choose, whether it's students trying to kill you, whether you're in an aerial survey airplane with a terrible engine and it quits on and you got to land on a mountain. Personal experience, or you go to freight and it's just a freight lifestyle that's like absolutely insane. And you really, one, figure out how bad you want this career. And two, you figure out how to survive this career. And also three, indirectly, I believe that it has helped us get the pay that we have right now, especially where we are. I mean, we're highly trained. We are, it has really helped the talent pool and it has really kind of helped everything. For, I don't know about quality of life, but pay and getting to an airline.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, we've talked about that before. The industry is definitely losing a lot of experience, a lot of domain experience, a lot of sage wisdom as these groups of pilots hit retirement age. And so, you know, we'll see what happens in the coming months, coming years in terms of, you know, the lowering of the experience base, whether that's by flight hours or just life experiences or whatnot. I agree with you. I do agree. Impressive for the families of the Colgan flight. They were able to go out and get these changes and they're able to defend the changes. And I don't think anything's going to change anytime soon. That's for sure. And yeah, be careful what you wish for, right? You get these lower minimums and then all of a sudden you don't have any CFIs left, right? Because no one's left to train them. So there's a lot of different things that go into that.
But you're also in the race of single pilot, right? Or automation or some kind of automation help, which we're running out. We can talk about automation another time. That's we could talk about that every day for the next 10 years until it's here. You know, like it's something. That was another thing people said is like ban single pilot or ban this. Like, I don't think it's possible to ban it. I think it's possible to slow it down and make sure it keeps two pilots in the airplanes for hopefully a long time. But at some point, I unfortunately believe it is inevitable. Inevitable. Wow, can't talk today. I believe it's on the horizon. There's only so much we can do, and we can fight for safety and make sure two pilots are always there. But to say that the technology is not going to be implemented in these planes, I mean, we talked about this before. The 797 was supposed to be designed to solely be a single pilot airplane, but still have two seats up there. So, like, do the math.
Right. And I know we've talked about it a little bit, but you're right. I do believe it's inevitable. I know people get mad when I say that, when you say that. But the truth is, if you just look at the history of aviation, I mean, the crews have been shrinking through the years and through the generations of aircraft. And it's a logical way it's going to go. We can oppose it. And certainly right now, today, 100%, you got to have two people up there because our system is such that, you know, one pilot up there today would have difficulties. I mean, for instance, think of the Sully Sullenberger accident where a bunch of Canada geese get ingested. I mean, you know, you got to have people up. Automation isn't going to be able to do all of that stuff. However, I will tell you, there's a sociological line coming up. And, you know, as the younger people get used to this automation, I just bought a car a couple of weeks ago and it has the auto drive, especially on the highway.
It's pretty nice.
And it's shocking. It's shocking. If you've never been in it, it's especially if you're used to drive. I mean, it takes your breath away. You're like, is this thing going to stop? Oh yeah, it stops perfectly. Is this going to make the lane change just right? Yep. And it's shocking. And I would have never guessed in a million years that that we would see that so soon. So as these new types of technology infiltrate into everyday life, I do think, especially with the younger generations, they're going to be a little more trusting of technology. I do think, like, when things like the 797 come out, you are going to probably see a lot of pressure to reducing that flight deck. Again, I don't think it's going to be we've talked about it before, I don't think it's going to be a light switch where all of a sudden one day the FAA says, okay, we're certifying single pilots. But I think you're going to start seeing things like on augmented crews, perhaps on freight to start, right? And then over time, you'll start seeing them chip away. And eventually someday, I mean, my guess is our children's children will look out at the airline transportation industry and see a very different industry in terms of people and in terms of technology. It's going to be very different than what we could have ever imagined.
Yeah, and like I said, we can talk about this forever. So we'll do a more in-depth episode on this, but that's all we got for today. Jim, thanks for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it. And we'll do it again soon.
Sounds good, Justin. Always looking forward to it.
Always. That's a wrap on episode 270. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy this. Like I said before, go ahead and take your friend's phone and subscribe to the podcast. Share it. Show them my Instagram page and make them listen to me there as well. But Aviation, hope you're having a great day. And as always, happy flying.